Are we still on?
Oh, yeah, we're still live, but my live, recording encoder just stopped. Okay, so we're going now. So, nobody missed anything. So,
all right.
The website, themeathouse.com. We do have a call-in number. It's 818-921-4680. If you catch the show live, want to join us, 818-921-4680. We'd be glad to take your call anytime during the show and talk about whatever's on your mind, as long as it's about mead. What are we drinking tonight? Aaron, you got some kind of raspberry thing going on there.
I do, yeah. This is the batch of mead that I briefly talked about last week on the show. My raspberry Melomel, bottled back in December 2014. This is that one that I just had the joys of forcing all of those raspberries down the tiny little neck of my glass carboy, and my wife was there. It was a labor of love with her being a second pair of hands there for me, both getting them in and then the fun of getting that raspberry sludge out on the back end, but breaking this open tonight.
Awesome. And Jeff, what are you drinking there tonight?
I've got a little project of mine that I spent most of last year on. It's kind of a hybrid braggot of porter grains and the Boucher, like caramelized mead. So it is so dark that it is absolutely opaque, and it has that wonderful, rich, like malty, toasty complexity you get from the both the porter and the caramelized honey.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
And Chris, are you off them pain meds yet?
not really.
So Chris,
I have got a nice cup of Starbucks Keurig dark roast.
Chris, you're on the wrong show, man.
Hey, this will have to do for now.
Oh. Yeah, Chris still fighting off that car wreck he was in here a couple of weeks ago. So, but I'm glad you're doing better. I talked to him last night, and he's getting to sound like the old Chris I remember. So,
good to hear.
Yes,
I'm drinking.
Well, I shook off the cobwebs by now, so I'm good.
There you go. I'm drinking a batch of Kentucky Wood. This is a hard cider that I made, it's probably been about 8 months ago or more. And this is about the most simplest recipe that I've found. And it's one of my first batches of hard cider that I made. And it's just simply apple juice, brown sugar, and yeast. And I think I used a Nottingham ale yeast. It's 5 gallons of apple cider, apple juice, and 2 pounds of brown sugar. And, you just let it ferment out until the yeast just gives up and dies. Rack it off into a clean carboy, let it all settle out real good. It becomes clear. And I dropped one of them oak spirals into it, an American oak. I think it was a medium toast oak. And let it sit in there for, about maybe 10 days. And this tastes like, it tastes like an apple juice that's been sitting in a wooden barrel that's got a kick to it. You know? So
sounds good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's got that tart apple flavor, just a hint of sweetness, and the sweetness actually almost tastes like it comes from the apple itself. And then of course you get that whiff of that oak barrel, and that taste, that woodsy taste from the oak barrel. So it's real good. I'm real pleased with it.
That sounds real tasty, JD. How does that brown sugar translate through? Do you get any of that flavor after it ferments out?
No, not really. And I need to figure out if it's the, why you couldn't use any other kind of sugar, or even, I guess, if you used the honey, it would be called a sizer, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know that the brown sugar really imparts any flavor to it at all. I suppose it would if you took it up to the sweet side, you know.
Yeah. Kind of boosts the alcohol a little bit. And
yeah.
I think something maybe like some turbinado sugar that's absolute raw sugar would probably impart more flavor than the brown sugar. But
yeah.
I bet in a side-by-side comparison, I bet you could tell the difference.
Yeah, could be. This came out to about 12% ABV. So it's, you know, maybe the lower end of the wine scale. But to drink a full 375-mil bottle, it'll lighten your head up a little bit for sure.
I like it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things that just kind of creeps up on you after a while. It tastes really good, and the more you drink, and the lighter the head gets, you know.
Yeah, that's like the hydrocodone. They do some of the same thing.
Send you a bottle.
If I could just figure out how to get some oak flavor on them, we'd be set.
Who needs mead?
Yeah, gosh. No kidding. You know, tonight we were going to talk about putting a sweet mead together, and the first part of the show, and then go into dealing with stuck fermentations. I know we've all been there and done that. Chris and Aaron been both really contributed to this sweet mead recipe, and Chris, this is kind of your baby. I know you've done this recipe before. Start it out for us. What are we looking at here?
Okay. This is a recipe that I've done many, many times. It's a favorite of everyone that tastes it. And I had suggested that maybe we should start out, since this is a new show and there may be brand new mead makers listening, we need to start out with the basics. We use a lot of terminology that people may not No, we just kind of throw these words around because we've done it for a while, but new mead makers may have no clue what we're talking about. So I wanted to cover some of the terminology that we're using, give you a good basic recipe that will get you started. And it's been made enough now that I know for a fact if you follow the directions, it's going to turn out good for you. And you don't have to have a lot of equipment and things to do, but there are some things that are essential. This is going to be an orange blossom sweet mead, and we're going to add a little bit of vanilla at the end, just to kind of enhance it a little bit. You're going to be using 20 pounds of orange blossom honey, and you're going to need to get you a 7.9-gallon bucket, a fermentation bucket. They're available at most all homebrew shops and online homebrew stores. I think they run about $15-16 bucks or so. You're going to need that extra space. So, and the other two pieces of equipment you're going to need right off are a Lee's stirrer that mounts in a hand drill. And you can, if you don't have a drill, you can borrow one from your neighbor. And you're going to need a hydrometer and start learning how to use your hydrometer to take a specific gravity. And so basically you're going to put 20 pounds of orange blossom honey into your big bucket. You're going to add about a gallon of spring water. And you're going to mix it up until the honey dissolves. And at that point, you're going to have basically a syrup. You're going to then continue adding water until you get up to somewhere around 5 gallons. And then you're going to stop and take a hydrometer reading. Just make sure that you have everything mixed up and incorporated well, because you won't get an accurate reading if it's not fully dissolved. So what you're looking for is a gravity of about 1.134 you'll hear us refer to that as 1134. We usually just leave out the decimal, and so that's how we'll, when you hear us talking about something that's 1050, that's 1.050 on your hydrometer. So you're looking for a gravity of 1134. You're going to probably need to add a little more water past 5 gallons. You should be coming up somewhere, give or take, 5.5 gallons, and that's going to leave a little extra so that when you do your racking later on or your siphoning, you won't have to worry about getting into the sediment. And you'll be sure to be able to top up your 5-gallon carboy all the way up to the neck. So you get this mixed up.
Let's back up to the honey for a minute. When you add the honey to the bucket, you know, there are a lot of websites out there that people go to, and I'm going to keep harping on this, you know, during our shows when we talk about it, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. Chris, you don't heat the honey up at all, do you?
I don't heat it for the purpose of sterilizing it. Now, if you're working in a cold environment, there's nothing wrong with setting the container of honey down into a bucket of, you know, hot water. But that's only to loosen it up so that you can get it all out of the jug.
Right.
There's absolutely no reason to heat it. We're not making beer. We're not, you know, we don't need to sanitize honey. Honey is pretty much sterile as it is.
Well, what happens when you heat honey up beyond a certain point, beyond a certain temperature, it really does something to the aroma and to the flavor, and it can have an effect on the outcome as well.
Yeah, you'll lose the subtleties of it. It's these little subtle differences that make all these varieties of honey different. And so if you heat it up, you're going to lose all those subtle aromas and aromatics. And, so we want to keep those. But there's nothing wrong with setting the container of honey down into some hot water just to loosen it up so that it pours easily. But it doesn't really need to be over, you know, 85 degrees or something like that.
Yeah.
So we don't heat the honey. You might hear this referred to as a no heat method.
Right.
So we've got our honey and water mixed up. We've got somewhere around 5.5 gallons. We're looking at a gravity of 1134. 1134, anywhere in that area is good. And so now we're ready to rehydrate the yeast. And do you want me to explain that, or you, Aaron or Jeff, you want to go through that process?
Yeah, Aaron, you got some pretty concise notes in here. Why don't you pick it up from there and run us through the rehydration process, which is kind of important because, I mean, a lot of people out there, again, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation out there. People just, you know, tossing the yeast on top of their must in their 5-gallon bucket and hoping for the best. It may work, but, you know, whether it's right or wrong, it's not up to me to say, but I just think making a starter, rehydrating it according to the manufacturer's instructions. But to go ahead, Aaron.
Absolutely. I think it's all about just kind of gently waking that yeast up and rehydrating it to kind of bring it back to life there so that it can kick off to a nice, healthy fermentation.
Yeah.
So, you know, from here, kind of the next steps would be to heat up about 1 cup of water, about 250 grams. Just the hotter, the better is typically the approach that I've taken. And I'll preface this by saying from here on out, a lot of the instructions that I've taken here are from Sergio's website, meadmaderight.com. Definitely a great resource with some really good instructions that has yielded some pretty favorable results for me in the last few batches I've worked with. So heating up that, you know, that one cup of water from there, the first thing that we'll want to do is add in 12 and a half grams of GoFirm to the hot water. I'm also going to kind of bounce around back to Chris, your instructions that you had here too. So at that point, you want to dissolve it completely into that hot water and let it cool to 104 degrees Fahrenheit, at which point, Chris, I saw you had, you've recommended kind of pouring that hot water GoFirm mixture into a large, like, glass casserole dish. And I think the reason for that, and it's kind of interesting, it's something I haven't really seen in the past, but the reason for that is it allows more surface area for a more even rehydration of the yeast, you know, rather than sprinkling that yeast up in kind of a narrow topped vessel or glass or something like that where it might get all clumped up. You can just really evenly sprinkle it out into that larger container like that. From that point on,
prevents the yeast from clumping up.
That's right. Yeah, that makes sense. And this is another interesting thing too, is once you sprinkle that yeast on, you're saying don't stir it. Is there any reason for that?
Let it take on the water as it wants to. That way, you know, you're not forcing it to rehydrate. Just let it take it on as it wants to.
Okay.
Kind of a natural rehydration.
Yeah, just sprinkle it on top and leave it alone.
And by the way, this is the recipe is on our website, themeathouse.com. It's called Sweet Mead Recipe. It's right there at the top of the page. If you want to go there and you can download it, copy it, whatever you need to do. Also, we're using the 71B yeast, and we're using 10 grams or 2.5, usually that yeast comes in 5 gram packages, if I'm not mistaken. So
that's correct. Yep.
And I will just throw in one little note here. The manufacturer suggests that the water be 110 degrees when you add the GoFirm. I've also seen other places where people said, you know, the hotter the better, but the only thing that I can figure out, that the reason Lauben says 110 degrees is because there are some amino acids and proteins that are in GoFirm, and amino acids at certain temperatures can denature. And what happens when an amino acid or a protein denatures, it becomes more difficult to assimilate. We as humans, we can assimilate it because we have very complex digestive systems that can break it down. That's the reason we can cook an egg well done and eat it, and we still get the benefit of the protein. But organisms like yeast, they don't have that complex digestive system like we do. They may not be able to use amino acids that have been denatured. I don't know exactly what the temperature is that requires an amino acid to reach to denature it, but that's the only reason I can think of why they suggest 110 degrees is to prevent that from happening. Because, you know, the vitamins and minerals that are in there, they should be stable well above that. So that only leaves the amino acids to worry about. So a little technical information there.
Well, and I think, you know, for lack of anything else, I mean, if you're really not sure, follow the manufacturer's suggested method of rehydration. It's on the back package of, you know, virtually every package of yeast you buy. Or you could go to the, you know, the manufacturer's website and, you know, get the information there as well. One important thing about the water, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on when we talk about stuck fermentation, is you don't want to boil your water, because if you do that, you boil the oxygen out of the water and the yeast will really, really struggle to get started and even survive a rehydration at that point. So.
interesting.
But after now, you know, we're looking at this Go-Firm product. This is a nutrient that's specifically used for yeast rehydration. Correct.
This is yours.
Yeah, I believe so. The instructions that I have on the package, I actually have like a Go-Firm Energy, and it says it's like a complex blend of yeast nutrients, like you're saying, just specifically designed to, you know, bring that yeast back to a rehydrated state.
I think in other places it's called Go-Firm Protect. I've heard it called different things, Go-Firm, Go-Firm Protect.
Maybe that's what mine is the Go-Firm Protect.
The Go-Firm Protect is suitable more for higher gravity meads. There's a little difference, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but the Go-Firm, either one will work fine for this. Once we get into talking about some higher gravity starch, you're probably going to want the Go-Firm Protect, but either one will work for this.
So we're at this point. We've mixed roughly 20 pounds of honey, and we've brought our water up to about the 5.5 gallon mark. Now it's you want to have a little bit of extra honey because to get and you're not looking for specifically 5.5 gallons. You're looking specifically for a gravity point of at least 1.13034 is better for this recipe. So, and I think that's pretty important to note here. Whether it's 5.75 gallons or just under 5.5 gallons, when you're mixing your honey, I always hold a little bit back. I run my water in, and then I fine-tune the batch until I get to my desired amount, which is usually 5.5 gallons, and my specific gravity. So you just, you're adding water, adding honey, adding water, adding honey, until you get to a point where you're comfortable with the gravity.
Just make sure that everything is mixed thoroughly and dissolved. Otherwise, you will not get a true gravity reading.
And one thing about, for people who are doing this for the first time, to start out, you can go to any brew shop and you can buy a kit that comes, you get your fermentation bucket, you get a glass carboy, you get the racking cane, various pieces of equipment, hydrometers. That's a pretty good way to start out. And these kits, I've seen them run anywhere from $100 to even $120. Rather inexpensive, really, to start out. So,
and since let me just say one other thing before Aaron goes back to his rehydration. On this mixing of the water and honey, I've made this recipe so many times, I can tell you that if you put in 20 pounds of orange blossom honey, and then you pour in water until you reach the 5.5 gallon mark, you're going to be good.
Yeah.
I can tell you right now, you're going to be good on the gravity. So, if you want to just keep it simple, let's just keep it simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And to me, that was kind of a turning point for me when, a lot of these recipes that you go out to the local homebrew supply shop and it just tells you mix in 15 pounds of honey with, 4.5 gallons of water to get to 5 total gallons. And it's more just telling you the amount of honey and the amount of water. To me, that kind of would lead to, sometimes inconsistent results in the final gravity. And, by structuring your recipe around what your original gravity is, and then, taking into account the alcohol tolerance of the yeast that you're using, and kind of tailoring or kind of setting your target final gravity based on that, I think that's a really good way to go. But, for the beginners out there just getting started, just get the 20 pounds of honey, top it up to 5.5 gallons, and you'll be good to go.
Yeah. You should be right. You should be looking at about 1134 if you do that. You may be a point or two up or down, but you're going to be close enough for this recipe.
You'll be in the neighborhood, exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I think from there, you know, we left off, we had sprinkled our yeast into this kind of a wide glass casserole dish to allow for that even surface area and to allow the yeast to kind of take on the water as it needs it. From there, this is another kind of key point here, is to let it sit for about 20 minutes. And Chris, I noticed you suggested placing that casserole dish in like a microwave or other kind of dark, secluded place where it's, you know, it's warm, it's dark, and you don't run that risk of having any other debris or anything falling into it.
Yeah, I have a cat that likes to jump on everything, and so that doesn't mix well.
I could see that. Yeah, that might be a bad situation there. So after about 20 minutes, you know, you want to kind of gently stir it with a sanitized spoon, kind of slowly. And at that point, you want to start tempering that yeast slurry by adding small amounts of your honey must back to the yeast slurry to kind of slowly bring that temperature down. You know, I think you don't want to rush this process. So add in some of the honey must and take a temperature reading. If you're not quite within, you know, 10 degrees of the must temperature, let it sit for another half hour and just take your time with that process. Once I started doing this, it really made a big difference. One of the last batches that I did, like the yeast slurry was starting to, you know, foam up and bubble and sizzle a little bit there before I pitched it into the batch. And I think that just comes from tempering with small amounts of the honey must and just slowly letting it come to temperature, to that temperature range. Once you do reach that point where you're within 10 degrees, then you're ready to go ahead and pitch that yeast slurry into the must. And by doing that, you're also avoiding temperature shock of, you know, too rapidly decreasing that temperature, which can undo all of the good that you just did by carefully going through that rehydration procedure.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea also, you got your leaf stir that you mixed up your honey and water. And by the way, for the beginners out there, once you mix your honey and water together, it's called a must. And before you pour the yeast in, it's a good idea to hit that again with your stirrer to kind of whip some oxygen into that honey and water mixture. That's going to help the yeast to have that oxygen in there. So hit it with your drill, stir your lee stir, and then take your drill out and then pour your yeast in.
Yeah. All right, so quick recap here. We've mixed 20 pounds of honey, orange blossom honey, with approximately 5.5 gallons of water. We brought the gravity up to about 1.134 or so. We've rehydrated our 71B, Lalvin 71B. That's 10 grams of 71B yeast with 12.5 grams of GoFirm at 104 degrees. We've added back a little bit of must to temper that yeast slurry to bring it within 10 degrees of the temperature of your must. And your ambient temperature should be somewhere around 70, 72, 74 degrees, I would think. And we pitched the yeast. You stir it into your must. And at this point, what's next, guys?
Jeff, you want to go from there, or you want me to do it?
Well, sure, I can take it from here. The next thing we're going to do is hang out for a little while. We're going to wait for some signs of activity, and we're going to wait for the yeast to start bubbling. Usually, that should happen within about 24 hours. Sometimes it takes a little longer, and that's fine if it does. And once we get some signs of activity, we can start talking about nutrients.
So Jeff, real quick, would this be a good time to crack open a bottle of mead to drink?
Is there a bad time to crack open a bottle of mead to drink?
Well said.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
Now, I don't have all the show notes in front of me, so the exact amounts are escaping me at the moment. But I know we're going to split this into four different batches. We're going to add the first batch about, and if I remember correctly, these are about one quarter of the total amount each.
Yeah, it's the blend, the nutrient blend is 2 teaspoons of DAP, diammonium phosphate, and 1 teaspoon of Firmaid K. We're going to mix those 3 teaspoons together in a container thoroughly, and we'll use 3/4 teaspoon per addition.
So that would be, you can mix that up ahead of time, put it in a small jelly jar, mason jar.
Yep.
You know,
I use an old medicine bottle or something.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Jeff.
So anyway, we're going to add that first addition about 24 hours into the ferment. Usually the way I like to do this is to pour off around about a cup of the must and just mix it in slowly. You're going to expect this to foam more than a little bit, so you really want a larger container than a cup measure. I found that's out the hard way. The additions have a lot of surface area that all that dissolved carbon dioxide from the fermentation is going to kind of like glom onto and release from. So you get a little bit of a foam explosion. But the reason we're doing this in the cup is so that this happens in the mixing cup and not in your fermenting tank by itself. So yeah, you want to get that nicely mixed up. You add that back into the must, and then generally, I like to degas before I add. It helps get rid of some of that carbon dioxide and prevents nasty foam ups from being really bad.
Yeah, I've been there and done that before too.
Another good reason not to ferment in a carboy, unless you want meat on the ceiling.
Yeah.
Been there.
Yeah, reserve the carboys for secondary ferment only.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, so we want to follow the degassing regimen and nutrient additions, and the next addition is going to come at 48 hours and then 72 hours. The way I usually do it, and I don't know if this is per the recipe or if the recipe is just another day after that, but I usually go about the one-third sugar break, which is it's either another day or another 2 days most of the time. But that one-third sugar break is a terminology meaning one-third of the available sugars have been fermented. So if you look at a hydrometer reading, in this case, we'd be talking, and I'm trying to think off the top of my head, in the neighborhood of 1065, if I'm not mistaken. No.
480, 1084, yeah, something like that, 1085, yeah. For the purpose of this recipe, I just did 4 additions, 24 hours apart. You're going to be close enough. It'll work fine that way for the beginner, without having to calculate the 1/3 sugar break. Just do it for 4 days in a row, 24 hours apart.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so we're at 4 days later, here we are, we've got our nutrients all mixed in, and like Aaron said, now would be a good time to crack open another bottle of mead because you've got a significant weight on your hands. That doesn't mean to say that you're not without something to do. There's still some maintenance, some management that you still need to tend to, you know, during this process.
We're gonna degas twice a day for the first 7 days, and you're gonna use your drill mounted lead stirrer to do that, and you're gonna do it once in the morning and once in the evening, and one of those times each day is gonna be when you add your nutrients in. But I think I made a note in the recipe, do this twice a day only, no more. We want this mead to finish sweet, and we don't want it to be overly alcoholic. You're going to end up somewhere in the neighborhood of a 14% alcohol mead with this recipe. If you start to degas more and you're getting in a hurry, you think it's not going fast enough or something, you're just going to, you're going to cause that yeast to just way overshoot where you want to be. So do it two times a day for the first 7 days. The first 4 days, there's going to be a nutrient addition with one of those degassings. And another important part of this recipe, if you notice in the instructions, you cover this with a towel and just put a rubber band around it. Do not put a lid on it until you do your final degassing. When you do your final degassing, you're going to put your airlock on, your lid with your airlock. But those first 7 days are going to be with a towel only. Now, if you guys remember, last week I told you we were going to talk about some oxidative and reductive ferments. Right. Well, this is going to fall. This particular mead, we haven't gotten into that yet, but just for people wondering, this is going to fall into the more of the oxidative ferments, because we're leaving the top where it can just fully breathe. We've got a piece of cloth or a towel or something over the top to keep out the bugs and fruit flies, but we're not putting it under airlock until day number 8.
Yeah.
So we'll get into the reasons for that later on in another show, but just cover it with a towel until you get through degassing.
And again, this recipe, you can download, copy, paste, whatever you need to do. This recipe is on our website, themeadhouse.com. Just look for Sweet Mead Recipe and take the notes and get it started. You can get all of this. Everything in this recipe is pretty readily available. Orange blossom honey is a very common honey you can find just about anywhere. You know, your local brew shop should have 71B. That's a very common yeast that's used by Lalvin. They should also have the nutrients. Now, there may be an issue trying to find the Go Firm Protect and the Firmaid K. Jump on Amazon.com or a place, another good place, another shameless plug. We don't do any advertising on our show, but hey, you know what? Resources are resources. Another great place to get equipment and things that you need for doing this is morebeer.com or morewine.com, basically the same place. I know that they carry the Firm AK brand and the Go Firm as well. But if you can't find it there, go ahead.
I get almost everything from More Beer.
Yeah.
Morebeer.com has got just about everything you need.
Yeah.
And also, JD, I think we covered everything in the instructions as best as I can remember, but if anyone has any questions about it, they can always go to themeadhouse.com and look up the contact us button and send us your questions, and we can try to straighten them out.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this recipe is meant to be a very simple first time out. If you've never made mead before, you know, this is a very simple process, very simple recipe. You know, it would probably take you less than an hour to put the whole thing together. You know, I guess the wait time would be waiting on the yeast to rehydrate. Actually, that would be the longest period of time involved. But and like Chris said, this is going to generate a sweet mead around 14%. You know, so sounds like a good recipe. Sounds like something I might even do.
It's going to come down, it's going to finish out probably around, I've had it stop at 10:30, and I've had it go as low as 10:24, which is still, any of that is a good range.
Yeah.
But you're going to leave this once you put the airlock on it. You're going to do no more stirring, no more degassing. You're just going to let it sit for an additional 2 weeks. So you're going to be looking at 21 days from the day you pitch the yeast. At 21 days, it should be finished by that time, or very, very, very close to it. And then you're going to siphon, which we call racking. You're gonna need a racking cane to do that. And if you go to your homebrew supply or websites, you can find those. They're easy to operate, self-explanatory. The main thing here is that you're gonna siphon this into a 5-gallon carboy, and you want to leave behind the sediment that's gonna be in your bucket. So that's the purpose of having the 5.5 gallons, because you want to have enough so that you don't have to put your racking cane all the way down in the bottom. So you want to avoid that sediment, and you're going to rack it into your 5-gallon carboy. You're going to take one vanilla bean, cut it up into about 1-inch pieces or so, drop it in, leave it for about 2 to 3 weeks. After about 3 weeks, you're going to siphon that into another 5-gallon carboy, leaving behind the vanilla bean and any additional sediment. Put an airlock on it and forget about it for a while.
And
your work is done.
A while could be several months.
Using this particular nutrient regimen with the DAP and the Fermaid K, you're probably going to be looking at around 6 months before you're really going to enjoy it, maybe even a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Aaron has so graciously done the math already for using Fermaid O if you prefer to use the Tosna approach. And I think we're going to post that up as an alternative to the nutrient regimen that I had posted along with the recipe.
Yes.
So if we get that posted up, you know, it's up to you. It's your choice which you want to do. The reason I chose to use the DAP and Fermaid K in this example is because it's what most people sort of consider the standard way to go. In my experience, and I believe in all of you guys too, the Tosna or even just a Fermaid K approach by itself makes a much faster drinking mead. But that's up to you. We just wanted to give you some options, and so Aaron has done the math on the Fermaid O if you choose to use that. But if you do use a Fermaid O, let's make it clear, you're not going to use the DAP and Fermaid K at the same time.
So to answer Scott Monroe's question, I know he's listening in tonight. He just put up a question on the Facebook page. He wanted to know how soon this is going to be drinkable. And so, Scott, we're looking at probably somewhere around 6 to 8 months before you can go ahead and bottle this up and begin to enjoy it. Longer is usually better. And in subsequent shows that we do here on the Mead House, we'll be talking about some more recipes. Some recipes, that'll put you in a bottle and have you drinking it, in about 3 months. So look forward to that. But this particular recipe, you know, you're probably looking at anywhere between 6 and 8 months before you can really actually enjoy it. So
it depends on how much of an alcoholic you are.
Yeah.
I mean, you can drink it right out of the primary bucket if you really want to. But now, if we're talking about how long before you enjoy it, then probably a little bit longer. another thing that we did forget one thing. This needs to ferment at about 62 degrees. And that's probably going to be the biggest issue for new mead makers, because they're not going to have a way to accurately control the temperature. It's going to depend on how warm the room is, that where your bucket is sitting, and all this kind of stuff. But you need to be around 62 degrees if you can. What I would suggest for beginners, if you don't have a way to control it accurately, set your bucket into a shallow pan, put water in it, and wrap an old T-shirt around your bucket, and let that T-shirt hang down in the water, and maybe put a fan on it or something. You would be surprised how much you can drop the temperature by 10 degrees easily by doing that.
Yeah,
that evaporative cooling effect, absolutely. That's when I used to brew beer down in Florida before I moved to Wisconsin. That's an old trick I used to use. The wet T-shirt and the fan on it, too.
Yeah, it's kind of a rough and ready way to do it, but hey, I've made some pretty good mead like that, so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What, when we, you know, we were talking, you know, getting this recipe started, you know, we've got it in the bucket, it's fermenting, and then you wake up one day and there's no movement in the airlock, and we're like, you know, maybe 32 hours into this thing or less. You know, when we went to bed the night before, I mean, it was churning away just fine, bubbling away, and then suddenly it just came to a stop. This is the second half of the show here tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about stuck fermentations and, you know, how to recognize them, what do you do about it, and even, you know, I guess we can go into how to prevent them as well. But before we get to that, Aaron, can you quickly take us through the TOSNA approach as an alternative to the nutrient feedings for this sweet mead project?
Absolutely. So as I think Jeff and Chris were indicating, with this DAP and FermAid-K approach, essentially it's a mixture of 2 teaspoons DAP and 1 teaspoon FermAid-K. Those 3 teaspoons get mixed together and then added as a staggered nutrient addition after 24, 48, 72 hours, and then another one either you know, on the fourth day, or for the more advanced mead maker, at the 1/3 sugar break. For the TOSNA approach, essentially what we're going to do is we're going to replace that FermAid-K and DAP mixture with FermAid-O. And this is another one where, you know, the local homebrew supply shop nearby may not carry FermAid-O. So the morebeer.com and Amazon, that's how I've procured mine, was just through Amazon, may be a good way to get this. But essentially, what Sergio Mutella on his website recommends is getting yourself a nice gram scale to be able to measure out the weight of nutrient additions. He's got some calculations. Maybe on a future show we'll get into exactly what goes into those calculations. But based on this batch size and starting gravity of 1134, each of these nutrient additions would be about 11.25 grams of FermAid-O. So the essentially
if I can
the
interject
same.
Here,
go for it.
Yeah. Speaking of procuring things on Amazon, the gram scale can be had really cheaply on Amazon. I picked one up for about, I think, $7. So the idea of buying extra equipment shouldn't be a barrier to doing the TOSNA at all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That, you know, that's just a key point as well for me is, you know, honey is just so gosh darned expensive. And if you're going to invest all that money in good quality honey, you know, get yourself the $7 gram scale and invest in that, because it'll help, you know, make all the difference for your meads.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's basically the Tosna method right there. The same type of a thing. After 24 hours, 48 and 72, you would just draw out a small amount of must, maybe one cup or so, mix in that Fermade O. One of the things I've noticed when using Fermade O is that it doesn't necessarily bubble up quite as much as the Fermade K and the DAP mixture, but it definitely clumps up real bad and kind of makes these little Fermade O dough balls. So, it takes some effort to kind of break those apart and make sure that the nutrients is evenly mixed into that must before you reintroduce it back into your primary fermenter.
Maybe throw in a blender, huh?
Yeah.
Speaking of procuring more equipment, I mentioned that leaster that mounts in a drill. If you have any doubts about it, let me tell you now, get the leaster. They're a little bit expensive. They're kind of pricey. They're $24-$25 for what seems like something that's real simple. If you try to do this, you can mix the honey and water with a long-handled stainless steel spoon, and about 1 minute into the process, you're going to be slapping yourself in the face going, why didn't I buy the leaster?
Yep.
Definitely. So, that'll make your life a lot easier.
Yeah, and
one of those tools that once you got it.
Yeah, you're going to be using it to be gas twice a day, and trust me, get the leaster. Spend the $25 and get a leaster. If you don't have a drill, borrow one from your neighbor. But get the leaster. Don't try to do without it. It's just going to save you so much headache. Even if this is the only batch of mead you ever make, buy it and then give it to someone else who wants to make mead if you don't want to use it anymore.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And when I first started out, I just absolutely refused to pay the. Actually, I think it was more around the line of $30 for that damn leaster. So I went down to the hardware store and I bought an anodized paint bucket stirrer, and that's what I started out. It works just fine. They're a little on the heavy side, though. You hook it up to the drill and get the stirring around. It takes a little bit of work to keep it off. You want to keep it off the sides of your bucket for sure, because you don't want to mark up the sides of the bucket. But it did get a little heavy, and I finally broke down and bought one of those leaf stirrers, and I'm kind of glad I did. So it's a good investment. So
the leaf stirrer, they have the little plastic wings on them, so they don't scar your bucket up.
Yeah. Yeah,
and another thing too is later on when we start getting into degassing our finished meads, they will fit down into a carboy. So that's another good thing.
Yeah, where a paint stirrer won't. Because when I got to that point, I thought, okay, now what? And that's when I had to break down and finally buy the leaf stirrer. So
yeah.
So now we're 24 hours, maybe 30 hours into this, and we were chugging along just fine, and then suddenly everything just kind of ground to a halt, and no activity. Now, even by this point, let's say it's after the 7 days, you've taken the towel off, put the lid on with the airlock. You go to bed that night and, the bubbler's just churning away, looking good. And you get up in the morning and, you might get a couple bubbles every couple of hours, or maybe none at all even. So now what? And we call that a stuck fermentation, right, guys?
First thing to do is check the airlock and make sure that it's sealing good. Might check your lid. Because the airlock activity, if there's none, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not fermenting. So make sure, first of all, before you panic, that you've got a good seal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, first steps. And there are several reasons why it may have gotten to this point. And it even starts in the very beginning when you rehydrated the yeast. Remember I said something about not using boiled water. If you boil the water, you boil the oxygen out, and the yeast really struggles to get a good start. Now, it may look good when you go to pitch it, but it's really got to work overtime to, you know, to get things going and start munching on all that honey. The other thing that might affect it is temperature. I found that out the hard way. You know, in one of my early, you know, I couldn't figure out what, you know, what's going on with this. I followed everybody's directions. My mentor, Pete Bakalich, was helping along with it. And suddenly it just ground to a halt. And it's like, okay, you know, I spent all this money on stainless steel fermenters, all this honey and everything, and nothing's working. And it turned out it was temperature, you know, which is probably, I don't know, Chris or you guys, I mean, would temperature be maybe the number one culprit, do you think?
I think it depends on how far along in the ferment you are. You can never really completely rule something out, but, you know, like some of the things that can cause a stuck ferment are the temperature is too low or too high, usually too low. The pH is too low. There's a lot of things that can cause it. What I have found in my experience, if you're going to have a problem with pH dropping too low, it almost always has happened to me in the first 2 to 3 days. The pH seems to level out somewhat after about the third day. So if you don't stall because of a pH problem in the first 2 or 3 days, you're probably not looking at a pH problem. So you have to start looking at other things at that point. If it's later in the ferment, you're probably looking more toward temperature. Another thing you might want to do is just take a gravity reading and see where you're at. Because, right. Hey, I mean, just because we say something's going to take 3 weeks to ferment, you know, sometimes those yeast can really, they just turn into Superman, and you could be 7 days into the ferment, and it may be done. Right. You may not be stuck. It may just be finished. I've had meads to drop 30 gravity points every 24 hours, and, you know, it's going to finish up quick like that. So,
That's really rapid.
Yeah.
Well,
that's not normal, but it does happen. So.
Yeah. I think, you know, along the lines of temperature, and this is a lesson, and this is why we do this show, is to hopefully prevent, and, you know, our tagline, let us throw the honey out for you. You know, we've been there and done that, all of us here. So we're trying to prevent the folks that are listening or, you know, live or later on from maybe, you know, having the same mistakes that, you know, we've already been through. Temperature for me was a big deal, and this is what prompted me to actually, you know, get involved with the stainless steel fermenters. And I've got a chiller, you know, an immersion chiller that works very, very efficiently. Some Rube Goldberg projects that, you know, we'll talk about on future shows too. But temperature, it's important to note here that during the fermentation process, you know, your ambient temperature, let's say you're fermenting in a bedroom that might be 70 degrees or in a basement that's 65 degrees, the temperature of the must is probably maybe even 10 degrees higher because the act of fermentation actually increases the temperature inside your container, inside your fermenting bucket container. So. And that's
was it Jeff or Aaron who had the stories about the stuff?
Yeah, Yeah, Jeff got. In fact, let's turn it over to Jeff. He's got some pretty good stories here about this. So, Jeff, talk to us, bud.
Oh, sure. So when I was putting this together and I was thinking about all the really frustrating stuck fermentations, I decided to call this a history of bad decisions because I pretty much figured out how to deal with these or how I got to these situations because I made some really dumb moves learning how to do this. And I think this is right along the idea of let us throw that out for you because, oh, my God. The first mistake I made in my second batch, I had with the kit that I got from the homebrew store for making, you know, wine and mead, I had these little cannon tablets, and the instructions on the package indicated, oh yeah, you can use these to prevent oxidization when you're degassing, not degassing, when you're racking into a secondary container. So when I got around to doing the rack to secondary, I ground up, I think, three of those little guys and put them in the bottom of the carboy and racked onto that. That ended up completely stunning and basically killing the mead. I let it sit for a few days, kind of like, well, are you going to do something? Anything? You know, I tried kicking it with a little extra nutrient, seeing if that did anything, and it didn't. And finally, I ended up having to repitch, and everything turned out okay. That was kind of mistake number one, and it was only my second batch out. Contrary to Chris's experience, though, I found that I have a number of pH drops later in fermentation. I want to say typically 2 or 3 weeks in is where I've seen a couple of them. One of them happened with a high gravity meat that I was trying, and at this point in time, I wasn't doing any kind of a staggered nutrient addition. I was just kind of dumping everything into the start, and I wasn't degassing hardly at all. So the meat was probably running pretty hot. I know you can get a buildup of acids from fermentation and things like that, and that's not uncommon, I believe, for hotter fermentations to throw some of those along with fusel alcohols and other kinds of stuff we're trying to avoid. And I assume that's what happened here. But in this case, I got a little bit of calcium carbonate from the homebrew store and used it really sparingly, a little bit at a time, and I finally got that restarted. I think I ended up repitching too, just because it wasn't really churning through. And the calcium carbonate seemed to do the trick, but then the next time that happened to me, I was making a hibiscus mead. And that, the calcium carbonate, maybe I wasn't as careful with it, but it ended up leaving a really chalky residue taste in the mead that just, it killed all the enjoyment. And I was trying to let it settle out, and I was trying to let it relax, and that it just kind of, you know, settle down to the bottom with the leaves and settle out, but then the recipe ended up oxidizing anyway, and we had to throw it out. So that is one of the few batches that I've had to just get rid of entirely.
Yeah.
Now, did you say you were using calcium carbonate or potassium carbonate?
Calcium carbonate is what I got from the homebrew store, and I do understand from what I've heard lately, you do get better results with potassium bicarbonate, if I'm not mistaken. But calcium carbonate is what I got from the homebrew store, so it's what I used. Yeah.
That's probably where your chalky taste came from, was the calcium.
I'm pretty sure.
Does the potassium bicarbonate, does it, Jeff, from what you've heard, it doesn't necessarily impart such a chalky off flavor?
That's my understanding. I have no actual experience of it with myself.
Okay. Interesting.
So
I've only used it one time, and that was potassium. There's potassium carbonate, potassium bicarbonate. you can use either one. I think what I used was potassium carbonate. And like I said, I've only used it one time, and I didn't notice any flavor impact at all from it, other than reduced acidity.
Gotcha. Yeah, I kind of a funny story. I went and bought, looking at the package here, 1 pound of potassium bicarbonate and have never used it, never needed to use it, so it's still sitting here in the package sealed up.
How many of us starting out with mead? You know, you and I think I wrote about it on the website about my, you know, when I first started doing this. You know, my trip to the homebrew store, I'm standing in this place just bewildered, you know, and I'm looking at all this stuff. None of it makes any sense to me whatsoever. And, you know, the guy walks up, you know, kind of help you, and says, well, you know, I'm trying to act like I'm informed. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to make, I make mead. So I need equipment. Well, what do you need? And I said, well, everything. So I came home with, I got a shelf of chemicals here that would outfit a science lab very nicely.
And we're talking about accumulating equipment. A pH meter is one of those things that you look at, and you look at the price tag, and you go, yeah, I can get by without that for now. And you just don't need a pH meter until you need one. And then when something goes wrong, then you're scratching your head and you have no way to know. Hopefully if everything goes right, you never need this stuff, but when you need it, you need it. And, this is a hobby. I mean, let's face it, you're going to spend money on hobbies, no matter what you do. And there's a lot more expensive hobbies than meat making.
Sure.
You're talking about $15-16 for a fermentation bucket. What's a hydrometer going for now? About $7?
$7-$8.
Yeah, $7-$8. You get a gram scale that's accurate down to a tenth of a gram for like $7 or $8. A rack and cane is 15. Leaf stirrers, 25. Carboy is about 35. pH meter, you can get a decent one for what, about $75 or so.
Oh, the one I used was like $15 off of Amazon. I got to calibrate the damn thing every time I use it, but hey, you know, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're going
for mine, and I have to calibrate it every time too.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably a good idea, but the point is, you know, you're looking at, $250-$300 to really get outfitted.
Yeah.
And then there's other things that we're going to talk about later that you're going to probably want to get at a later time. But if you're starting out, you're going to spend $200-$300 on equipment. You got to remember, this is a hobby. This is something that most of this stuff you're purchasing, you can use over and over. You never have to buy it again.
Right.
So just look at it as an investment, and you're going to get a lot of enjoyment from doing this. So don't skimp on this stuff, because, like I said, you're going to be beating yourself over the head when something goes wrong and you don't have a way to find out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's an investment. After making a lot of mistakes in my early batches, the several hundred pounds of honey that I wasted, I finally broke down and bought, I spent roughly $600 on a stainless steel fermenter and an immersion chiller set up, and I've invested, since then with my whole little DIY, cooling system that I have. But, so yeah, you're right, Chris. I mean, it's a hobby. You got to spend some money at this. Aaron, you got, not Aaron, Jeff, tell us what happened to the wedding mead.
The wedding mead obviously was a special batch. I mean, we had, A friend of mine is a beekeeper, and had lost a hive and wound up with about 30 pounds of honey that he was looking to move at a pretty decent price. So I jumped on that like a fat kid on a cupcake and got all of it.
There you go.
Because it was a friend of a friend, it was a little bit special, and it was, you know, really nice, like, basic wildflower honey that had been barely filtered. I didn't want to mess with it, so I decided the bulk of it we were going to use for just a nice traditional semi-sweet mead for our wedding. And the fermentation got stuck, I want to say, right around when I was thinking about getting it racked over to secondary, it just kind of stopped on me. I checked the gravity, and it wasn't quite at alcohol tolerance. So I kind of said, well, you know, what's wrong with this? And I checked the pH, and it was down around like, oh, I want to say 2.8. It was really low. I had just had that really awful experience with the hibiscus we had to dump out, and so I didn't want to do more of the calcium carbonate and risk making that nasty. Right. But I kind of didn't have much of the choice. So I did a little of that, and I also didn't want to risk oxidization because that got things really awful. And we were at this point, I want to say about 7 weeks away from the wedding, and I needed something to serve. Yeah. So I realized, no, I need to degas it, because I had read somewhere the dissolved carbon dioxide can mix with the water to form carbonic acid, and there's a chemical equilibrium at place that prevents much of that from happening, but it's enough that it can, if there's a lot of dissolved carbon dioxide, it can persist and it can lower your pH for you. So I knew I had to degas, and I had to get more of that out, because I think I got lazy with degassing early in the process. So I was far enough along that I didn't want to risk oxidization, and I figured out the best way to do this is to just do it really gently. So I put that leaf stirrer on the drill, I stuck that in there, and I let it go just slow enough to get some of the bubbles like out of the ferment, and I did that several days, really gently, really painstakingly, and finally we got to the point where I was ready to use some fining agents, and by the time we were done with the fining agents, that last bit of the calcium carbonate taste had filtered out, and it wound up being a really good mead that we were happy to present at the wedding.
Cool.
If I had hair, I would have been pulling it out trying to get it there, but it wound up great.
Yeah, and it's a pain in the butt when you have to baby a mead like that you know is going to be good, but you have to just coax it into being good just because of mistakes. You know, it's really frustrating when you have to do that. But,
yeah. I know, from a personal experience with a project that I started some months back, you got to be really careful with the pH stuff. And there's a point in this mead making where you can get too involved with it. And I think that's what happened to me. I just, you know, I read so much about the pH that it turned into a real concern. And I really shouldn't have had that kind of concern over this. I found out later on that it was really, it's really not a big deal. If you do everything right, control your temperatures, do your degassing. I mean, this is, as much as this is a hobby, it's also like having a child. I mean, you have to maintain it. You got to feed it. You got to babysit it. You got to take care of it, if you want to enjoy the end result.
If you will sort of take the approach that the yeast are your pets, while you're making the mead, and take care of them as such. And every pet has its own needs. And yeast are, they're a unique pet, and you got to take care of them.
Yeah.
It's a good analogy.
I know the one, and I'm not going to go into all the detail, but the one project was a pumpkin that I was really looking forward to next November. And it got to the point where the pH started to go a little bit haywire, and I started adding acid. By the time I got it to the standard 3.4, the end result was that it was, how did I put it, Chris? Enough, it was like licking the inside of a galvanized pipe. That's all.
You said it was like licking a 9-volt battery.
Yeah. I mean, it was bad. And then, you know, people told me, just let it sit a while. I was like, no, nah, you don't get this. This is not ever going to be okay. Maybe in 150 years, but this is not
good. Yeah, and I told JD that I said, you made the fatal mistake. You know, in the first part of fermentation, when you're managing it and you're feeding it and putting your nutrients in and degassing, you're pretty much going by numbers then. Yeah. But once fermentation is over and you're in secondary or tertiary or whatever, there comes a point when you got to stop going by numbers and start going by taste. And JD, you were adding acid going by numbers. You were trying to get it to where you thought the numbers should be rather than just tasting it and saying, this is good where it's at. I'm leaving it alone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. So, since we're coming close to the end, I think we should probably at least cover real quickly, a little bit about restarting a fermentation. We've talked about all the things that can cause a fermentation to stick. You know, I should have done my homework a lot better than I did, but let me just say that I believe on the Loudon or Lalamond website, there is a protocol on there. If you'll search around on their website, you will find their recommended protocol for restarting a stuck fermentation. I'm doing this from memory. It's been a while since I looked at it because I've only had to restart one so far, thank goodness. But when we were talking about the sweet mead recipe and we were talking about tempering the yeast, where we, after we rehydrated it, we added in some must. The restart process is very similar to that. And like I said, go to that website and you can get the details. But basically what you're going to do is you're going to make up like a one liter of must that's at a lower gravity than your original batch was. And you're going to start your yeast in that. And you're going to let that sit for 24, 36 hours or whatever it takes to get that, to get a good solid fermentation in that. And then you're going to start adding in small increments, your original must that's stuck. So you add, I think it was like half the volume of your starter. So you add a half a liter slowly, and then you don't do anything else to it until you see good, strong fermentation. And then so you add a little bit more. And you keep doing that, and you keep waiting until everything's going good. And once you've reached a certain volume, then all of that goes back into your original batch that's stuck. And that's the way to restart. That's if you were using the same yeast. If you're trying to restart using the same yeast. Now, there are some yeasts that are tolerant to a lot of different things that are good for restarting. I believe K1V 1116, or is it EC 1118?
Yeah.
There's a couple that Loudon recommends that are good for restarting stuck fermentations. I will say that 71B is pretty doggone tolerant. I've seen 71B do some amazing things, especially when you're working with a high gravity. I've been making some batches lately that have started at 1162 for a starting gravity.
Wow.
And the 71B just takes right off. The heart murmur is one of those.
Yeah.
It's starting way up high. And the heart murmur, you know, it just, you put the 71B in, you rehydrate it, you temperate it, you pitch it, and it just takes off. But that kind of gravity would kill most yeast as soon as it touched it.
Yeah. Well, 71B is pretty much of a workhorse. I've used it several times, and I've noticed the same thing. I mean, so many of the stuff that I've done, it's usually 24 hours later before it really starts taking off. But 71B, it's like, you know, it's like, let me in there. It's just a matter of hours before I see bubbles start appearing in the airlock. So,
yeah.
But, yeah.
And even though Laubin doesn't recommend it as a restart yeast, it's tolerant. In my experience, at least, it's tolerant to fairly low pHs. It's tolerant on low temperatures. Yeah. It's tolerant to high gravities. And it's a pretty doggone good yeast to restart with. Everybody's going to have different experiences, of course.
I think it's always wise to try to restart with the same yeast that you pitched, because I know certain yeast can impart different things, in your muscle. I mean, to me, that would be the first rule of thumb, is to always use the yeast that you started with. But if you get to a point where, you've tried everything, the recommended yeast is the EC1118 by Laubin. And I guess a general rule of thumb, guys, is to put a solution together, one part water, one part of your stalled must, and put your yeast in. And, even if you got a quart jar that you could put an airlock on, let it get to a good rolling start, and that might take you 24 hours. And then slowly, work it back into your must, and, it should take off from there. So, but, I think the big culprit is probably temperature. I mean, if you don't have some way of controlling your temperature, because like I said, the inside of your house might be a comfortable 72, even 74 degrees. Don't forget that, when you pitch your yeast and it starts working and starts really working hard, the temperature of your must is probably going to be approaching 85 degrees. And that's pretty mm-hmm. much on the higher end of where you need to be. Cool it off if you can. You repitch your yeast, try the 1118 trick, usually that will bring it back. If it doesn't, there's probably something else that's really gone wrong. And you just, like all of us, you just might wind up pouring it down the drain and feeding the garbage disposal. So,
yeah. But before you go through the restart process of rehydrating yeast and all, use your pH meter. Check your temperature. Try warming it up. Try if your pH is below 3. That's just a general number. You need to look it up. Depending on your yeast, but check your pH and try some potassium carbonate if it's too low. Try to fix what's wrong first and see if that. Give it 24 hours and see if it works. It may bring it back to life. And then your last option is to start rehydrating yeast and making another starter and tempering it to your must. So kind of go in order. Do the simplest things first. And
well,
this
go ahead.
This has been an interesting discussion for me. I'm just kind of taking some notes here. In my experiences, fortunately, haven't had too many instances of stuck fermentations where I've had to get things going again. You know, I think another key point I'd emphasize is, as you know, you're doing some of these corrective actions to get the fermentation back on track, and even if you don't experience a stuck fermentation, just another good practice is to, you know, take good notes of what's going on throughout the fermentation. Some of it, you know, we were talking about managing the fermentation by numbers. So if there's things like taking a pH measurement or a gravity reading 24 hours in, 48 hours in, 72 hours in, just to keep track of progress and where things are going, you know, that's always a good thing to do. But also qualitative measurements or qualitative notes as well. You know, what's it tasting like as it's progressing through the fermentation as well.
And on your logbook, when you're taking your notes, one of the first things you need to write down before you even open your yeast, look on the yeast packet, and there should be a lot number on there, and write that lot number down. And so if something does go wrong and you do get stuck and you have to end up repitching, don't repitch from that same lot number, because it may just be a bad batch.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, me neither.
That's something new. I just want to throw another shout out to Scott Monroe. He's out of Corinth, Mississippi, a neighbor of Chris's down there. Scott is he's a chemical engineer, and he's been listening to the show. We were talking about pH meters having to be calibrated every day. He says he's a chemical engineer, and he used them quite extensively during his career as a chemical engineer. So we've got the backing of somebody who's been in the business. So yeah, if you got a pH meter, plan on calibrating it every time you use it.
I got an email from Scott. Yesterday or day one, yeah, and. He said he wanted to hook up with me when I got a chance, and he was going to give me some of his mead to try, and I'll try to have some of mine bottled up, and we might make us a mead swap when I do a little bit more recovering.
Yeah. How are the chickens doing?
The chickens are almost ready to come out of the brooder, and they're almost fully feathered now, so... hopefully by the end of July, sometime around the 1st of August, I'll be getting eggs. So,
my first thought when Sherry sent me a text about Chris's accident, my first thought was, oh, crap, what about the chickens? I'll explain that on another show. But we're pretty much at the end of the show, and we need to get ready for the after show here. Real quick recap, we're talking about a sweet mead recipe that's really simple to put together. If you follow the instructions that are included on our website, themeadhouse.com, copy it, paste it, print it, whatever you need to do, you should wind up with a pretty decent mead in about 6 to 8 months. If you find yourself getting stuck during fermentation, you know, some of the things we talked about, recognizing why it got stuck, check the pH, check your temperatures, repitch if at all possible with the same yeast that you started out with. Chris brought up a good point. Try to stay away from the same lot number. If you can get another package of yeast from a different lot number, try that. If all else fails, try that EC 1118 yeast. That's been known to be a terrific restarter, but you got to do it right. You have to put together a one-to-one starter with your clean spring water and the must out of your bucket, and let it come to a good ferment, and then slowly add it back into your must.
So and if that all fails and you have to pour it down the drain, then you get your official Mead Makers membership card and say, welcome to the world of mead.
Call us first, though. We might be able to help you out. And, hey, do you have a question? You want to talk about something? And I've gotten some emails from folks. A gentleman whose name escaped me at the moment, but wanted us to entertain a discussion about carbonating. So we've got that on the list as well. But if you've got a question, you've got a topic that you want to know more about, hey, just go to the Contact Us page on themeadhouse.com. And we'll be certainly glad to include it on the show. You can also give us a holler. Call us anytime during the show. And if you got a paper and pencil, write this number down, 818-921-4680. We'll take your calls all during the show. All we ask is you just don't be a knothead, that's all. Guys, next week we're going to be talking about managing a difficult fermentation. So now that we have put our mix together, we've got it in the bucket, we helped it out when it got stuck, now we need to dig in a little bit deeper and start talking about how do we manage this thing efficiently so that we do get a good outcome. We'll spend a little more time about on the next show. But Aaron, Jeff, Chris, good show tonight, guys.
Absolutely. And hey, before we call it a night, just a quick shout out and congrats to our very own Jeff Schaus. Just wanted to say congratulations to Jeff. I saw that he took a third place medal here for a hibiscus mead here at the Mazer Cup. So congratulations to Jeff.
Oh, wow, dude. How come I didn't see that note?
And we'll all be expecting samples.
Yeah.
Any of it that's left, we'll see what we can do.
UPS delivers even in Mississippi. So,
wow, would you be? Are you willing to share the recipe?
Yeah, I'd be willing to share what I've got.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's up to you. Give me a holler, and we can get it posted up on the website. But damn, congratulations!
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, big time. Big time congrats.
And all right. To be fair, it's not just hibiscus. It's actually a blend of hibiscus and chamomile. But the hibiscus is we actually won a third place with a straight hibiscus mead the year before. So the post I made was about consistency and like, yeah, third place again with hibiscus. Awesome.
All right, guys. Well, hey, until next week, Tuesday night, 9 o'clock, right here at themeadhouse.com. Check it out. We'll see you next week.